Nicholas Parsons.
Yes.
Congratulations on 50 years of Just a Minute.
Almost. By the end yes. of the year.
Yes. Well, we're meeting just in advance of that. But that's what the celebration's about. And also, I have to say, shall I say it now?
Say whatever you like,
celebrated your. You've just celebrated your 94th birthday.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I can't believe I've lived so long. You don't think about it when you're younger. I mean, you just assume you're going to be much the same as you are then as the years go by. And it's only when you reach your 90s, you do realise, I am a bit older.
You're a bit older,
you
but
you begin
you're...
to slow down a bit. You can't do all the things you used to do, including climbing the stairs at a good pace.
Well, I don't like doing that very much. No, you've managed extraordinarily well, and I'm going to ask you what your secret is. But first I want to know something that a lot of my friends have asked, which is this. Great fans of Just a Minute, and we want to know, have you ever been put in the position of a contestant, even as a joke?
Yes, several times.
Yes.
Well, the BBC once had a slot of 4 weeks, and they had this idea, because then we had 4 regular players, you know, which was...
Clement Freud.
No, together, are we?
Sorry.
Kenneth Williams, Derek Nimmo, Peter Jones, and Clement Freud.
Of course.
And they had this idea, why not put Nicholas on the panel, and each of them can be chairman for that for one of those 4 weeks. And so this is what happened. And it started off with Clement, and he was always very aggressive, and he was rather inclined to give always the benefit of the doubt to the other people, with me, and make sure I didn't win. Derek Nimmer was next. He was a little over the place, and I did win that one. Peter Jones did it best of all, the chairmanship, and I think I won that one. Kenneth Williams, I mean, he was so ill-suited to the role, but he was hysterically funny. Ian Messiter was sitting beside him because he had the stopwatch and blew the whistle. And really, Ian Messiter ran it. And Kenneth was sort of saying, oh, I don't know, oh, yes, yes. Oh, shall I give it? Oh, I love that, yes. Oh, shall I give it to him? No, no. Oh, no, I can't give it to him. No, he's coming up. Who's winning? Oh, no. Oh, what's the next subject? I don't know. And it wasn't just a minute. It was a bit of a pastiche.
Indeed. And you remind me about in your Kenneth Williams impersonation that you were an impressionist when you started.
That's how I began in show business, yes. I became a Carol Levis, who was the great discovery man of the period, a Carol Levis discovery. I was then trying to be an engineer to please my family, which I didn't want to do, though I was quite good at engineering. I was up in Glasgow on Clydebank serving an apprenticeship, and Carol Levis came to the Glasgow Empire. And I asked to do an audition. I was accepted, and I came down to London and did a midday show on the weekend because I was then registered to military service, but I was in a reserved occupation. And I remember the two impersonations I did, which was Charles Boyer and James Stewart. And it was a show called Carol Levis Carries On. And then later, the BBC were encouraged by the government to run as many comedy shows or light entertainment shows as possible. In order to keep up morale. And they took a disused cinema in Bangor in North Wales, and they used to get people to travel to Bangor on the premise, of course, that the Germans wouldn't overfly Britain and bomb something in Bangor. Mind, there was nothing to bomb in Bangor anyway. And I got a whole series with it. And I and another young impersonator called Diane Darney, we were described in the show as Nick Parsons, that's what I call myself then, and Diane Darling, the radio deceivers. And I had to get down from Glasgow on the weekend, changing trains somewhere near Preston, I think, and going straight along to North Wales and Bangor. I mean, the amusing story is that during the war, a lot of people won't realise this, the government, in their wisdom, took down all the signposts throughout the country.
That's right.
And all the station signs everywhere. And everything like that, on the premise that if the Germans ever landed, they wouldn't know where they were. The trouble is that nobody else in the country had a clue where they were.
Of course.
And some people never arrived. But I used to get to Bangor for over 6 weeks and did my impersonations. And I got a very good raw experience then for what I eventually wanted to do and eventually did finish up doing.
Which was?
Becoming an actor.
Actor, exactly.
But you see, this is what I say when people say, this country, we're inclined to pigeonhole people, particularly the press. Mm. And in America, if you can do more than one thing, you are credited for the diversity of your talent. But in this country, they want to confine you or pigeonhole, makes them feel more secure. So at different times, because I've done lots of different things, I've been labelled an actor, a comedy performer, a voice man, an impersonator, a presenter, a quiz show host, a game show. But the thing is, I'm all those things. But basically, one is an actor. And when people say, what are you? I say, I'm an actor.
Quite right. And you were a straight man to Arthur Haynes as well.
Yeah, but I was still acting.
Yes.
And of course, I took the role of the foil to the comedian in a different direction. Up till then, he'd been rather sort of stayed like Jerry Desmond, who just stood there with Sid Field and said, no, I don't wish to know that kind of either stage. But I would then, in these wonderful sketches written principally by Johnny Spate, I would play a character, usually a figure of the establishment, a doctor, a lawyer, a police inspector, a vicar, and so on. And so I was the foil, and you would call it the straight man, but I was acting a role in each different sketch.
Well, this is what you've become on Just a Minute, if I may say so, because you are, there is a habit and a tradition of guying the chairman.
Not with everybody. Only with your friends. I mean, Paul Merton, whom I'm very friendly with, Paul has got this wonderful gift to send me up, and he does it in such a way that you know there's no intention behind it to embarrass you. And also, if you've got a sense of humour, you have to be able to laugh at yourself. And if you're there, and Paul comes up with some facetious remark about me, and I'm there enjoying it, the audience love it.
They do love it. I just remember, it's actually in the Just a Minute book. It's actually a transcript of this little exchange where Paul says, in my car, I have a blow-up doll called Buxom Betty, as endorsed by Nicholas Parsons on YouTube, which is preposterous.
I think one of the best things he said was, at my 90th birthday party, he made a lovely speech, and he does this thing about, what a lot of people don't know is that Nicholas is a lot older than he looks, but he's actually mentioned in the Bible. I believe, actually, he did the gig at the Last Supper, and he said it didn't go very well. And you know, the audience, I'm a standee there, so the audience roared with laughter. But it showed great wit, but also great timing.
Yes.
Because he times it in such a way that you know it's fun.
Mm.
You know, you pull Pete a leg in real life.
Yes, it's your age that they're getting at quite a lot of the time, and which Kenneth Williams used to do. Even when you were so young.
Listen, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
This is what people say. Kenneth Williams was the only person who actually paid me compliments. And he'd often say, lovely chairman. Oh, he's a great chairman. Oh, he's wonderful. And people forget that. Yes, they remember the insults, don't remember the compliments.
Do you remember when Giles said that in fact he was your love child?
He said that about a lot of people, actually. He gets a good laugh.
It does. It's one of Giles's tropes. I'm going to say, when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
You
I'm still
young.
Quite young, actually.
Yes, I know. You look so young.
I'm quite young, but
you are.
Physically, I feel my age sometimes.
Well, when you were really young, even before you won the Carol Levis impersonation, with your impersonation act, do you remember any games on radio then that you enjoyed listening to? Games, I mean,
comedy shows. Remember, there was only one radio channel when I was young.
Yes.
And, of course, the big hit show then, which I loved, was ITMA.
Yes.
You know, Tommy Hanley, It's That Man Again.
Yeah.
And that went on, of course, during the war. And, of course, during the war, the government encouraged the BBC to put out as many light entertainment or comedy shows as possible to help keep up morale. So ITMA carried on during the war. And
Much Binding in the Marsh.
That came a bit later, because they did...
That was the 40s.
Four shows, you see. They did four shows devoted to the services. The RAF,
yes.
Kenneth Horne and Richard Murdoch were both, so I did Much Binding in the Marsh. Charlie Chester did Stand Easy, which was the Army. And Eric Barker did the Navy one, because he was in the Navy, which we call Waterlog Spa. I had the great joy and privilege of being in Much Binding in the Marsh, because Maurice Denham, who was the what they call the voice man then, was doing a film, and I had got, I'd been on the BBC drama rep, playing lots of different roles as an actor, but they knew I could do different dialects. I met Kenneth and Richard, and they engaged me, and so I was engaged to be on Much Binding in the Marsh, which was for two series. It was wonderful.
Yes.
And there was such lovely people to work with, Kenneth Horne and Richard Murdoch.
Oh, yes. And you had Richard Murdoch, Stinker, I believe he was known as.
Stinker Murdoch. Stinker. Richard Stinker Murdoch. That was the other thing we used to listen to. Yeah. Before the war, with Arthur Askey and Richard Stinker Murdoch, what was it called? It had a title. It was a very famous show. And I've forgotten.
Sorry, I thought we were talking about... No, you said there was another show besides Much Binding.
Before?
Yes.
During the war? Before the war?
Before the war. Oh. I can't help you before the war.
No, I'm saying, can't even help myself there.
Let me ask, is it more important for your panellists, I know they're all seasoned performers now, to be omniscient? To know lots of things that they can talk about, or a fount of jokes, or just good at stopping other contestants from carrying on?
They don't need to be good at any of them, but it's valuable to have those at your fingertips.
Yes.
The essence of success of the show, I always say, is it's a case of having fun. I sometimes think there's not enough fun in ordinary life because things are pretty serious these days.
They are.
But you see, the point is, you've got to keep going, and it's a fiendishly difficult game to play. So you don't want a subject which is too erudite. And, what's that lovely word you use? Omniscient?
Omniscient.
Yes. And at the same time, when they think of the subjects, and they often talk to me about them, it's good to think of a subject which you can take in different directions. Like, for instance, some Tower Bridge. So you can talk about the bridge, you can talk about the fact it moves up, you can talk about the Thames, you can talk about this. And they have scope there. And this is what you need, a subject which gives them scope to branch off in different directions. And of course, unless you're brilliant at the game like Paul Merton, and he goes off sometimes into the realms of the surreal.
He does.
And what amuses me is the fact that if you do that, you're actually technically deviating all the time, but nobody challenges him
because they're loving it.
They're professionals, and
they know
the success of the show, if they're real professionals, is more important than their individual success.
Exactly. It's the interpretation they give to that word.
Yes,
if you say stones, a very wonderful word.
Yeah.
I'm just offering it to you as a possibility. Stones. You can think how many different ways you can do stones.
Absolutely. And weights and stones,
things.
Pebbles on the beach, you know, they're all stones. Tombstones. You know. It's good to have a subject where there is scope. But again, I have to emphasise, I know what the subjects are before we begin, but you could not predict how any show is going because it is all utterly spontaneous. And this is what is so joyous about it. It's probably the only completely spontaneous show, but you see, we don't edit. You come on there as if we used to be in the old days, as if it's a live show. And I believe if you do a live show and know there's going to be no editing, it gets the adrenaline going in a certain direction, and you're more likely to have a success.
Well, clearly, adrenaline pumping through your veins every week, at least once a week when you're recording, is very good for you. Beneficial.
Obviously, yes.
But
I said somewhere in a book or in an article that I'm a great believer that the more you use your grey matter and your brain, it does help to keep you probably younger than your years. And I say, I have a job which requires so much mental agility and concentration. But aren't I lucky? I've got a job that I love doing, and it perhaps helps to keep me young.
Clearly, I would think absolutely right. people cannot believe that there is not a list of subjects that you're given, such as stones, or the periodic table, that's the example I thought of, which would, some people might say, I'm not a scientist, I don't know what the periodic table is.
Yeah.
And what more do you have to say? So, if you give
well, you wouldn't give
just
them
the
that.
Sub-
you wouldn't do
well,
that.
I'm sure you might. You give some very arcane and difficult things, often scientific.
No, more subjects like Jane Austen or something, so that you've got a subject which sounds erudite.
I could think of chaps who wouldn't have a thing to say about Jane Austen.
Well, then you could struggle to talk about. You at least know that she's an authoress, and that she's written a number of books, and she's very popular, and you know,
you'd have
then
to go off to a tangent about period drama on television or something. You would have to do your a tangent thing and hope that somebody wouldn't buzz you to stop you. Yes, it's such fun. Did you find it fun actually doing it yourself when you did it for the?
No, I found it a great challenge.
Great challenge.
You
yes.
have to concentrate in a quite yes. a different way.
Yes.
Because
yes.
the thing yeah. is, in between talking, you can switch off.
Yes.
I, when I'm German,
yes.
I can't switch off for a second. I have
yes.
to concentrate. I mean,
yes.
somebody once said, oh, do you have backup? Can you imagine in the radio show, has it repetition? I don't know. Let's play that back.
Yeah, yes.
Did he repeat it? I think.
Yes.
Yes, I think that was a rip. The whole show's gone.
Yes.
I have to know immediately, yes. And I concentrate.
That is
and
amazing.
I listen. I've obviously evolved a technique where, as they're talking, I listen to every word, and so that the words are somewhere lodged in my subconscious. So if they're challenged, I do know almost immediately, yes, you did repeat
yes.
the word.
Yes. That's, well, it's very extremely impressive. I think you described to me the essence of comedy as being, as needing to have, having...
Shall I repeat it?
Yes, please.
When you think about it, the essence of comedy is you pause for effect, you repeat for emphasis, and you deviate for surprise, and hopefully a laugh. Those are the three things you cannot do in just a minute, and yet we play for laughs. Now, isn't that the most incongruous and delightful thought?
It is. You often have recalled, including in this wonderful book, it's just jolly good value, I think. It's full of laughs. You in this book, you recalled the original pilot 50
oh,
years
yes.
ago,
yeah.
Because it had started out, Ian Messenger had started out with
One Minute, Please.
A similar game.
Yeah. Yeah. During the war, he, yes. or before the war, had a program called 1 Minute, Please,
yes.
which discovered Gerald Hoffman and one or two others.
Yes.
And it was very laid back, as those things were then. I actually had just won an award for the first satire show on radio called, in which I called Keep Taking the Tabloids. And... I wanted to get back to doing improvised comedy. So I went to see my friend Ian Messenger, and I said, Ian, you've thought of many shows on radio. Have you got one that you're trying to promote? And he said, well, I've adapted 1 Minute, Please, and called it Just a Minute. And I was the one who actually took it up to the head of Light Entertainment. And I said, what about this? Because I wanted to get on the panel. And I was accepted to be a panelist, because he said, yes, I like it. We'll commission a series. So we commissioned a series, and we were accredited a young producer called David Hatch, to whom I have actually dedicated the book.
The book, yes.
And this was David's very first job as a producer on the staff. And Ian Messiter is what I call a great inventor, but perhaps, I don't mean unfair, perhaps he's not such a good producer. And because he created rounds in that pilot, which was so utterly inhibiting, I couldn't see how the show could possibly succeed. I mean, we had a round where you couldn't use plurals, another round where you couldn't use the definitive article.
You now, couldn't say the. You couldn't say that at all.
And so, I mean, the show is fiendishly difficult game to play anyway. But with these things, it was a disaster. I mean, Chris could never get it going. And I'd already been, the producer, David Hatch, I left this out, came to me because the original chairman was going to be Jimmy Edwards, and I was going to be on the panel. And David Hatch said to me, he said, I can never get Jimmy on a Sunday when we wanted to record the pilot. Would you do me a favour? Please be the chairman for the pilot. And I said, no, David, please. I don't want it. I'm not right for it. I can't do that job. I think I must have done something right because I'm still doing it now. But anyway, I agree. He said, I'll do it. I'll make a promise. Yeah. If we get the series, I'll put you back on the panel. So we did this pilot, and as I said, it was a disaster. They didn't want it. And it was turned down flat. Well, I can understand it. It was awful. And David Hatch is very clever. Mm. He saw the potential. And he knew if he changed this, that, and the other, we could do it quite well. And he fought for it. I've been told he actually could have put his job on the line. Well, in the end, in order to keep David Hatch on the staff, not because they wanted the show, they gave him a series. And then David came to me and said, Nicholas, I've had to fight to get this series. The only one thing in the pilot they quite liked was your chairmanship. I said, but David, I was awful. He said, I know, but so was everybody else.
In what way were you awful? In the book you say you were a bit pompous.
I think I was very pompous. I mean, I was endeavouring to do a job which I wasn't, suited for. But as the years go by, if you're a professional, you assess what's involved and you find a way to do that job for yourself and for the show. Right. And this is probably what I've done because I'm still doing it after 49 to 50 years.
I wonder what Jimmy Edwards was getting up to on Sundays. Did he go...
Playing polo.
Playing polo, of course.
I think also Jimmy probably didn't want to do it because he used to do a thing called Does a Team Think? Which he chaired with four other comedians.
Yes.
And it was very similar type of thing. You know, chairman and others ad-libbing and being funny and so forth.
Yes.
And I suppose in that sense he seemed an obvious chairman.
An awful lot of those games have disappeared with that we remember from childhood. There was the petticoat line.
Yeah, another one of Ian Messiter's ideas.
Yes. And he obviously had lots of good ideas.
But the whole point... I believe if you take on a job, you have to be very much in tune with it and think about it and find ways to hone, increase. I mean, over the years, the show has changed dramatically from what it started.
Yes.
And I have added little additions and deletions which have helped to polish and improve. And I believe you hone something and go better. Because to prove my point, at the time we started, there were two other shows on radio called My Word and My Music, with the same four panellists, a male and a male chairman, which we have women as well, marvellous women, comedians about. Yes. But the point is, these shows were good of their kind, but they died a natural death because they were of that period and they faded away. Now, I believe if we kept Just a Minute as it was originally with the same four people and me there as well, and kept going in the same predictable way, we would have faded away. But over the years, we've adjusted it, improved it, polished it, tweaked it here, there, and there. You know, and I brought in little innovations, like giving the benefit of the doubt. And if someone comes in with a wonderfully funny thing, give them a bonus point.
Yes.
And so, and we dropped the idea you could repeat the subject, which originally you couldn't do. Little things that help to give it a longevity.
And
in some way, I think we've achieved it.
You have. And we must also mention the influx of very keen new people, comic people, natural comedians like Ross.
Ross Noble, yes.
Ross Noble and of course, Paul, we mentioned. Giles.
Jenny Clare.
Very good.
I can tell you, the show is... Occasionally, we have a new guest. And... Yes. However talented that person is, it's not an easy game to play.
No.
And they may have that extra something, which means they can play the game, or they may not. And we now have an unwritten rule that if you have a guest who's never played it before, we surround them with three regular players. Yeah. So on the basis that if they struggle a little, the regulars can be kind to them,
yes,
and I can be helpful.
Yes, well, you are, and it does help, and it does show, and it's always lovely. Does the audience change from place to place? Because geographically, you go all over the place.
No, we don't. We used to.
Oh.
But the BBC have cut back.
Have they?
We're now allowed to do only two shows outside London.
Oh, I didn't realise.
Because there's always two recordings at every show.
Yes. And perhaps I'm confusing with, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, because they're always going off.
Yes. For some reason,
yeah.
And I often say why, they do every show outside of
outside.
London. Mm. I don't know what it is, it's some arrangement they've got. But we do two, we always do a double recording up in Edinburgh, and we do one other. Mm. And they try to get as far away from London as possible
to do that,
yes, because Paul Merton has been up for a number of years. This year, last year, he didn't, but they paid for him to come up because he's an integral part of the
I think he is, and I'm so intrigued to know that he proposed himself. He proposed himself to the show.
No, I did.
Oh, I think...
No, I'll tell you the story. We were on a programme called Scruples, which came from the Midlands, and I never met Paul Merton, and we were both guests on this programme, and after it finished, it was quite a humorous interview programme, he came to me and said, Nicholas, we haven't met before, but I have to say, I do love that programme, he called Just a Minute. I said, oh my God, you'd be so good on that. Now, up to then, it had always been quite traditional. We didn't have it because we had the four regulars.
Yes.
And I'd never recommended anybody. I said to our then, it's a lovely story this, I then said to our then producers, and I said, this chap I work with up in the Midlands, Paul Merton, he loves the show. He's listened to it since a youngster in his bedsit. And I think he'd be a wonderful guest. And so it slotted in. And apparently, I didn't know, Paul had already written the only job he'd ever written to a request. And then the producer phoned me and he said, Nicholas, someone's dropped out and I've got to get somebody. I was thinking of trying that chap you mentioned, Paul Merton. Now, tell me, is he one of these alternative comedians? I said, no, he's an original comedian. Anyway, he phoned him up. And according to Paul, said, I'm going to give you an engagement. You do know that how we dress. He says, respect. He was traditional BBC, old arty BBC. And he said, we don't swear. And Paul's version is, he said, I think he thought he was booking Sid Vicious or somebody.
Yes.
Anyway, Paul was then cast, and he came against quite strong opposition. But he had such a flair for the thing. For a first-timer,
yes,
he was incredibly good. And so Ted Allen immediately booked him for three more. And he's never looked back. And I am delighted and thrilled that he often says, this is one of my favourite gigs. And
yes,
so he's now an integral part of the show. And I mean, the money you pay on radio is not vast. And I'm sure it doesn't affect his lifestyle very much. But he loves doing it.
Yeah.
And I love doing it with him. And the audience love hearing Paul.
Yes.
And they love the banter between us. And so it's a very happy marriage.
It is a happy marriage. And I think the essence of it, the charm of Paul, is that he smiles. He smiles in a way. He's got a deadpan face. And then at the end of it, he smiles. And
the oldie. Could you talk on the oldie without hesitation?
Isn't
repetition,
that interesting?
Without none.
The oldie was conceived as an antidote to the youth obsession of our age, which we still suffer from. Richard Ingrams, Alexander Chancellor, and Stephen Glover got together, put some money in, and there wasn't much money.
Money?
Money.
But you did very well. Did very well. Went so far. So there's the oldie.
What a test. I'm never going to appear. No, don't ask me. We won't, of course.
But you did very well for the first time. And I threw it at you.